unpaid young staff, Rhodes scholars preferred. Rosa Lichtenstein-Strauss sent her boy. He was 21, knew how to ingratiate himself, knew also how to work. Improbable as it appears against a field of Rhodes scholars, within a month, Hoover appointed the high school graduate wholesale shoe drummer as his private secretary. After the armistice, young Strauss shifted with Hoover to Paris, hastily picked up French at tutoring sessions over lunch, and helped organize the allocation of 27 million tons of food and supplies to 23 countries. On the side, he assisted the Jewish Joint Distribution Committee in its work of relieving the suffering of the hundreds of thousands of Jewish refugees streaming from Eastern Europe in the wake of war. Strauss believed God had planned his life, which contributed greatly to his self-confidence. God let him take up employment when he was 23, in 1919, at Kuhn Loeb, a distinguished house with a number of major railroads among its clients. 4 years later, he married Alice Hanauer, daughter of one of the partners. His salary and participation reached $75,000 a year in 1926. The following year, it escalated to $120,000. In 1929, he became a partner himself and settled into prosperous gentility. The 1930s brought him pain and grief. After resisting Chaim Weizmann's attempts to convert him to Zionism at a Jewish conference in London in 1933, "My boy, you are difficult," Weizmann told him. "We will have to grind you down." He returned to the United States to discover his mother, terminally ill with cancer. She died early in 1935. The disease took his father as well in the hot summer of 1937. Strauss looked for a suitable memorial. "I became aware," he reports in his memoirs, "of the inadequate supply of radium for the treatment of cancer in American hospitals." He established the Louis and Rosa Strauss Memorial Fund and turned up a young refugee physicist from Berlin, Arno Brasch. Brasch had designed a capacitor-driven discharge tube for producing bursts of high-energy X-rays, a surge generator. When Leo Szilard was working at St. Barnes with Chalmers in the summer of 1934, he had arranged for Brasch and his colleagues in Berlin to break up beryllium with hard X-rays. The experiment had been a success, and Brasch and four other contributors had signed the report to Nature, along with Chalmers and Szilard. If X-rays could break up beryllium, they might at least induce radioactivity in other elements. "An isotope of cobalt thus produced," writes Strauss, "would be radioactive and would emit gamma rays similar to the radiation produced by radium. Radioactive cobalt could be made at a cost of a few dollars a gram. Radium was then priced at about $50,000 a gram. I foresaw the possibility of producing the isotope in quantity and giving it to hospitals as a memorial to my parents." Enter Leo Szilard, still in England. August 30, 1937. "Dear Mr. Strauss, I understand that you are interested in the development of a surge generator with the view of using it for producing artificially radioactive elements. At present, I am not in the position of offering manufacturing rights under this patent. It is possible, however, that at a later date I shall obtain full liberty of action concerning this patent. If this happens, I shall let you have a non-exclusive license, royalty-free, but limited to the production of radioactive elements by means of high voltage generated by a surge generator. Yours very truly, Leo Szilard." Brasch and Szilard owned the patent in question jointly. Szilard's letter offers to give his interest away free of charge non-exclusively to Strauss, a politic salutation to a rich man. But not even Leo Szilard could live on air, and as Strauss makes clear in his memoirs, the two young physicists eventually asked me to finance them in the construction of a surge generator. On the other hand, Szilard, as usual, seems to have sought no personal financial gain from the project beyond, perhaps, basic support. In the time he could spare from observing the developing disaster in Europe, he was apparently trying to promote the building of equipment with which he might further explore the possibility of a chain reaction. He crossed the Atlantic in late September to reconnoiter. A friend remembers discussing the feasibility of an atomic bomb with Szilard during this period. In the same conversation, he spoke of his ideas for preserving peaches in tins in such a way that they would retain the texture and taste of the fresh fruit. When the surge generator negotiations bogged down in debates among the lawyers, the resourceful Szilard distracted Strauss with the idea of using radiation to preserve and protect the natural products of farm and field. The tobacco worm might be exterminated, for example. But would irradiation harm the tobacco? Among Szilard's surviving papers is lodged a fading letter from Dr. M. Lenz of the Montefiore Hospital for Chronic Diseases that reports the decisive experiment. On April 14, 1938, at 2:30 p.m., your six cigars were irradiated with 100 Kelvin, a filter-focused distance of 20 centimeters, with 10 minutes in front and 10 minutes over the back of each cigar. This gave them 1,000 R in front and 1,500 R in back of each cigar. I hope that your friend finds the taste unchanged. Szilard also bought pork from a meat market on Amsterdam Avenue, saving the receipt, and arranged its irradiation to see if X-rays might kill the parasitic worm of trichinosis. He even dispatched his brother Bela to Chicago to discuss the matter with Swift and Company, which reported it had in fact made similar experiments of its own. The surge generator project developed through the year, incidentally giving Strauss the opportunity to meet Ernest Lawrence, who dropped by to pitch the new 60-inch cyclotron he was building. The pole pieces were 60 inches across, but the magnet would weigh nearly 200 tons. Lawrence and his brother John, a physician, had arrested their mother's cancer with accelerator radiation and intended to use the big cyclotron to further that research. Strauss remained loyal to the surge generator. Segre encountered Strauss's Hungarian wizard in New York that summer. The elegant Italian was professor of physics at Palermo by then, married to a German woman who had fled Breslau to escape the Nazis with a young son. I left Palermo with a return ticket, and I arrived in New York. I met Szilard. Oh, what are you doing here? He was a good friend of mine. I knew him quite well. What are you doing here? What's going on? I said, I'm going to Berkeley to look at the short-lived isotopes of element 43, which was my plan. I'll work there this summer, and then I'll go back to Palermo. He said, you are not going back to Palermo. By this fall, God knows what will happen. You can't go back. I said, well, I have a return ticket. Let's hope for the best. But I had gotten a passport for my wife and my son before leaving, because I smelled that the situation was dangerous. So I took the train in New York, Grand Central, and I bought the newspaper in Chicago. I still remember it. I will remember it as long as I live. I opened the newspaper, and I found out that Mussolini had started the anti-Semitic campaign and had fired everybody. So there I was. So I had the ticket and went to Berkeley. I started to work on my short-lived isotopes of technetium, but at the same time I tried to get some job. Then I got my wife here. The pall of racism had dropped over Italy. The physicists at the Institute on Via Panisperna had been alert to the darkening Italian prospect since at least the mid-30s. Segre remembers asking Fermi in the spring of 1935 why the group's mood seemed less happy. Fermi suggested he look for an answer on the big table in the center of the Institute reading room. Segre did, and found a world atlas there. He picked it up. It fell open automatically to a map of Ethiopia, which Italy, in a show of fascist bravado, was about to invade. By the time the invasion began, all but Amaldi were examining their options. Fermi went off to the University of Michigan's summer school in Ann Arbor, renewing an affiliation he had begun with Laura in the summer of 1930. He liked America. He was attracted, Segre notes, with an ear for Fermi's priorities, by the well-equipped laboratories, the eagerness he sensed in the new generation of American physicists, and the cordial reception he enjoyed in academic circles. Mechanical proficiency and practical gadgets in America counterbalanced, to an extent, the beauty of Italy. American political life and political ideals were immeasurably superior to fascism. Fermi swam in Michigan's cool lakes and learned to enjoy American cooking. But the pressure of events in Italy was not yet sufficiently extreme, and Laura, Roman to her fine bones, was more than reluctant to leave the city of plane trees and classical ruins where she was born. Nor was anti-Semitism yet an issue in Italy. Mussolini had even declared he did not propose to make it one. There was less to hold the other men. Rossetti summered at Columbia University that year, 1935, and decided to stay on. Segre had shifted to Palermo, but began looking toward Berkeley. Pontecorvo moved to Paris. D'Agostino went to work for the Italian National Research Council. Amaldi and Fermi pushed on alone, Amaldi remembers. Fermi even jettisoning his daily routine for the distraction of experiment. We worked with incredible stubbornness. We would begin at 8 a.m. and take measurements. They were examining the unaccountably differing absorption of neutrons by different elements. Almost without a break, until 6 or 7 p.m, and often later. The measurements were repeated every 3 or 4 minutes, according to need, and for hours and hours for as many successive days as were necessary to reach a conclusion on a particular point. Having solved one problem, we immediately attacked another. Physics as soma was our description of the work we performed, while the general situation in Italy grew more and more bleak. First, as a result of the Ethiopian campaign, and then as Italy took part in the Spanish Civil War. Fermi taught a summer course in thermodynamics at Columbia University in 1936, as the Civil War began in Spain that would last 3 years, claim 1 million lives, and set Mussolini decisively at Hitler's side. The following January, Corbino died unexpectedly of pneumonia at 61, and the hostile occupant at the north end of the Institute's second floor, Antonio Losordo, a good fascist, was appointed to succeed him. That was a sign that Fermi's fortunes were declining in Italy, Segre notes. America, he concludes of those depressing years, looked like the land of the future, separated by an ocean from the misfortunes, follies, and crimes of Europe. If the Anschluss was a test of Hitler's strength, it was also a test of Mussolini's willingness to acquiesce to complicity in crime. He had posed as Austria's protector. On the night of the March 1938 invasion, Hitler waited near hysteria at the Chancellery in Berlin for a response from Rome to a letter he had sent justifying his action. The call came at 10:25 p.m., and the Führer snatched up the phone. "I have just come back from the Palazzo Venezia," his representative reported. "The Duce accepted the whole thing in a very friendly manner. He sends you his regards. Mussolini said that Austria would be immaterial to him." Hitler replied, "Then please tell Mussolini I will never forget him for this. Never, 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 no matter what happens. As soon as the Austrian affair has been settled, I shall be ready to go with him through thick and thin, through anything." The Führer visited Rome in triumph in May, parading into districts the Duce had ordered hastily facelifted to conceal their decay. Fermi's circle repeated the verse passed around the city by word of mouth, by which an indignant Roman poet greeted the Nazi dictator. "Rome of travertine splendor, patched with cardboard and plaster, welcomes the little house painter as her next lord and master." Italy would only be saved, Fermi told Segre bitterly, if Mussolini went crazy and crawled on all fours. The summer of 1938, July 14th, brought the anti-Semitic Manifesto della Razza, of which Segre read in the Chicago newspaper on his way from New York to Berkeley. "Italians are Aryans," the manifesto claimed, "but Jews do not belong to the Italian race." In Germany, the vicious distinction had been commonplace. In Italy, it was shocking. Italian Jews, only 1 in 1,000, were largely assimilated. The Fermi's 2 children, Giulio, a son, had been born in 1936, might be exempted since they were Catholic, born of a nominally Catholic father. But Laura was a Jew. She was spending the summer with the children in the Dolomites, the South Tyrol district, named for the magnesium limestone that rings broad basin meadows with the flat, sharp formations Italians call shovels. Enrico came up preoccupied in August to the meadow of San Martino di Castrozza to break the news. When Mussolini pushed through the first anti-Semitic laws early in September, the Fermis decided to emigrate as soon as they could arrange their affairs. Fermi wrote 4 American universities, and to avoid suspicion, mailed each letter from a different Tyrolese town. 5 schools shot back invitations. In confidence, he accepted a professorship at Columbia and went off to Copenhagen to Bohr's annual gathering of the Brethren. The previous month, the International Congress of Anthropological and Ethnological Sciences had invited Bohr to address it at a special session in Helsingør, Shakespeare's Elsinore, on the coast of Zealand north of Copenhagen. In the Renaissance castle there, Denmark's most prominent citizen used the occasion to challenge Nazi racism publicly before the world. It was a brave statement by a brave man. Bohr understood that the major Western democracies were not likely to rally to the defense of his small, unprotected nation when Hitler eventually turned to look its way. George Plaszczak, a Bohemian theoretician working in Copenhagen, whose tongue was almost as sharp as Pauli's, had already encapsulated that cruel truth. "Why should Hitler occupy Denmark?" Plaszczak quipped to Frisch one day. "He can just telephone, can't he?" Against the brutal romanticism of German blood and earth, Bohr set the subtle corrective of complementarity. He spoke of the dangers, well known to humanists, of judging from our own standpoint cultures developed within other societies. Complementarity, he proposed, offered a way to cope with the confusion. Subject and object interact to obscure each other in cultural comparisons, as in physics and psychology. We may truly say that different human cultures are complementary to each other. Indeed, each such culture represents a harmonious balance of traditional conventions by means of which latent possibilities of human life can unfold themselves in a way which reveals to us new aspects of its unlimited richness and variety. The German delegates walked out. Bohr went on to say that the common aim of all science was the gradual removal of prejudices, a complementary restorative to the usual pious characterization of science as a quest for incontrovertible truth. To a greater extent than any other scientist of the 20th century, Bohr perceived the institution of science to which he dedicated his life to be a profoundly political force in the world. The purpose of science, he believed, was to set men free. Totalitarianism, in Hannah Arendt's powerful image, drove toward destroying all space between men and pressing men against each other. It was entirely in character that Bohr, at a time of increasing danger, publicly opposed that drive with the individualistic and enriching discretions of complementarity. It was also entirely in character, when Fermi came to Copenhagen, that Bohr should lead him aside, take hold of his waistcoat button, and whisper the message that his name had been mentioned for the Nobel Prize, a secret traditionally never foretold. Did Fermi wish his name withdrawn temporarily, given the political situation in Italy and the monetary restrictions? Or would he like the selection process to go forward? Which was the same as telling Fermi he could have the prize that year, 1938, if he wanted it, and was welcome to use it to escape a homeland that threatened now, despite the distinction he brought it, to tear his wife from citizenship. Leo Szilard's Cambridge collaborator Maurice Goldhaber emigrated to the United States in the late summer of 1938 and took up residence as an assistant professor of physics at the University of Illinois. Szilard appeared at Goldhaber's new apartment in Champaign in September to finish work they had begun together in England, and stayed to follow the Munich crisis, for which purpose his host went out and bought a radio. Szilard understood, as Winston Churchill also understood and told his constituents at the end of August, that the whole state of Europe and of the world is moving steadily towards a climax which cannot long be delayed. Before deciding between residency in England or the United States, Szilard said later, I just thought I would wait and see. The Sudetes, the border region of mountainous uplift that continue across Czechoslovakia from the Carpathians to the Erzgebirge, sustained at that time a German-speaking, urban and industrialized population of some 2.3 million, about one-third of the population of western Czechoslovakia, formerly Bohemia. Nazi agitation began early in the Sudetenland. By 1935, a surrogate Nazi organization had become the largest political party in the Czechoslovakian Republic. Hitler wanted Czechoslovakia next, after Austria, to facilitate his dream of German expansion, Lebensraum, and to deny airfields and support to the Soviet Union in the war he was well along in planning. The Sudetenland was his key. Czechoslovakia had built fortifications against German invasion across the Sudetes. After 1933, it imposed restrictions on the Sudeten Germans in an effort to protect that flank from subversion. Hitler opened his Czechoslovakian campaign even before the Anschluss, asserting the Reich's duty to protect the Sudeten Germans. Through the summer of 1938, German pressure on Czechoslovakia increased, while the Western democracies maneuvered to avoid confrontation. By the time Szilard began listening to Maurice Goldhaber's new radio, the Czech government had established full martial law in the Sudetenland, but also offered autonomy to the region, in excess of what the Sudeten German party had demanded. These developments prompted the British Prime Minister, Neville Chamberlain, to propose a meeting with Hitler. Hitler was delighted. He invited the Prime Minister to Berchtesgaden. The last outcome he wanted was a Czechoslovakian settlement. He signaled the Sudeten Nazis to increase their demands. Chamberlain heard the extremist proclamation on the radio on September 16th as he rode out by train from Munich. A call for immediate annexation to the German Reich. Back in London on September 17th, he recommended the annexation. Hitler, he said, was in a fighting mood. The British and French cabinets at this time, writes Churchill, presented a front of two overripe melons crushed together, whereas what was needed was a gleam of steel. On one thing they were all agreed, there should be no consultation with the Czechs. These should be confronted with the decision of their guardians. The babes in the wood had no worse treatment. The two governments, citing conditions essential to security, decided that Czechoslovakia should cede to Germany all areas of the country where the population was more than 50% German. France had treaty obligations to Czechoslovakia, but chose not to honor them. Facing such isolation, the small republic capitulated on September 21st. The Anglo-French proposals invoked self-determination for the German-speaking areas they defined. Hitler had agreed to such self-determination when he saw Chamberlain on September 16th. Now, the Prime Minister met with the Chancellor again, this time at Bad Godesberg, on the Rhine outside Bonn, near Remagen. Hitler escalated his demands. He told me, Chamberlain reported immediately afterward to the House of Commons, that he never for one moment supposed that I should be able to come back and say that the principle of self-determination was accepted. Hitler wanted Czech acquiescence without self-determination by September 28th, or he would invade. Chamberlain did not believe, however, he informed the Commons, that Hitler was deliberately deceiving him. The Nazi leader also told the Prime Minister that this was the last of his territorial ambitions in Europe, and that he had no wish to include in the Reich people of other races than Germans. The Czechs mobilized 1.5 million men. The French partly mobilized their army. The British fleet went active. At the same time, a secret struggle may have been taking place between Hitler and the German General Staff, which resisted any further plunge toward war. The result should have been stalemate. But Chamberlain moved again to concession. Appeasement was at that time a popular and not a pejorative word. How horrible, Fantastic, incredible it is, the Prime Minister admonished the British people by radio on September 27th, the night before Hitler's deadline, that we should be digging trenches and trying on gas masks here because of a quarrel in a faraway country between people of whom we know nothing. He volunteered to pay even a third visit to Germany. He was, he said, a man of peace to the depths of my soul. He made the offer of a visit to Hitler, at the same time directly by letter, and the Führer took him up on it the following afternoon. Chamberlain, French Premier Edouard Daladier, Mussolini, and Hitler met at Munich on the evening of September 29th. By 2 a.m. the following morning, the four leaders had agreed to check evacuation of the Sudetenland without self-determination within 10 days, beginning October 1st. At Chamberlain's suggestion, he and Hitler then met privately and agreed further to regard the agreement signed last night as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. Before he left Munich, closeted with Mussolini, the Führer discussed Italian participation in the eventual invasion of the British Isles. Chamberlain flew home. He read the joint declaration to the crowd gathered at the airport in welcome. Back in London, he waved the declaration from an upper window of the Prime Minister's residence. This is the second time there has come back from Germany to Downing Street peace with honor, he told the multitude below. I believe it is peace in our time. A group of refugee scientists was gathered outside the Clarendon Laboratory at Oxford the next morning, discussing the Munich Agreement, when Frederick Lindemann drove up. Churchill had described the Czechoslovakian partition as amounting to the complete surrender of the Western democracies to the Nazi threat of force. Lindemann, Churchill's intimate advisor, was equally disgusted. One of the refugees asked him if he thought Chamberlain had something up his sleeve. No, the prof snapped. Something down his pants. A cable came along to Lindemann then. Have, on account of international situation, with great regret postponed my sailing for an indefinite period, stop. Would be very grateful if you could consider absence as leave without pay, stop. Writing, stop. Please communicate my sincerely felt good wishes to all in these days of grave decisions. Szilard. Szilard and Goldhaber found time during the crisis to write up a series of experiments with indium that they had started in England in 1937 and that Goldhaber and an Australian student, R.D. Hill, had completed before leaving for the United States. Szilard had thought indium might be a candidate for chain reaction, but the results indicated that the radioactivity in indium, of which Szilard had been suspicious, was caused by a new type of reaction process, inelastic neutron scattering without neutron capture or loss. Szilard was discouraged. As my knowledge of nuclear physics increased, he said later, my faith in the possibility of a chain reaction gradually decreased. If other kinds of radiation also induced radioactivity in indium without producing neutrons, then he would have no more candidates for neutron multiplication, and he would have to give up his belief in the process he still nicknamed Moonshine. That final experiment would be worked by friends at the University of Rochester in upstate New York, where he would travel in early December. Otto Hahn opened the September 1938 issue of the Computus Rendus to a shock. Part 2 of the Curie-Savitch study of the elusive 3.5-hour activity of uranium appeared there. Amid much conjecture, its most challenging conclusion was, taken together, the properties of R3.5H are those of lanthanum, from which it is not possible to separate it except by fractionation. Curie and Savitch believed that their R3.5H activity could be at least partly separated from lanthanum. It apparently did not occur to them that what was crystallizing out of solution might be another activity with a similar half-life, leaving a 3.5-hour lanthanum activity behind. They still could not believe, nor could anyone else, that uranium bombardment might produce an element 35 steps away down the periodic table. A Canadian radiochemist, then visiting Dahlem, records their German critic's response. You can readily imagine Hahn's astonishment. His reaction was that it just could not be, and that Curie and Savitch were very muddled up. Despite his threat to Joliot in May, Hahn had not yet repeated the Curie-Savitch work. Now he passed the Compte Rendus along to Fritz Strassmann. Strassmann studied the French paper and speculated that the muddle might have a physical cause. Two similar radioactivities mixed together in the same solution. He told Hahn. Hahn laughed. The conclusion seemed improbable. On second thought, it was worth examining. As the Czechoslovakian crisis broke across Europe, the two men bombarded uranium in peaceful Dahlem. They used a lanthanum carrier to precipitate rare earth elements such as actinium, if any, a barium carrier to precipitate alkaline earth elements such as radium, if any. Carrier chemicals made it possible to separate from the parent solution the few thousand atoms of daughter substances produced by neutron bombardment. A chemically similar daughter substance, traceable by its unique half-life, would lodge in the spaces of the carrier's crystals as those regular solids formed from solution by chemical precipitation and would thus be carried away. Which carrier accomplished the carrying gave a clue to the part of the periodic table to which the unknown daughter substance belonged. Then it became a matter of further separating the daughter substance from the carrier by fractional crystallization, following it, as before, by tracing its characteristic radioactivity. After a hard week's work, Hahn and Strassmann succeeded in identifying no fewer than 16 different activities. Their barium separations gave them their most startling results. Three previously unknown isotopes, which they believed to be radium. They reported their findings in November in Naturwissenschaften. The creation of radium, element 88, from uranium, they pointed out, must be due to the emission of two successive alpha particles. If the physicists had found it hard to swallow that slow neutron bombardment might produce thorium-90 or actinium-89, they found it even harder to swallow that it might produce radium. Lise Meitner wrote in Warning from Stockholm, suggesting pointedly that the two chemists check and recheck their results. Bohr invited Hahn to Copenhagen to lecture on these strange findings and try to concoct a sufficiently crazy explanation. Bohr was skeptical and asked me if it was not highly improbable. I had to reply that there was no other explanation, for our artificial radium could be separated only with weighable quantities of barium as carrier substance. So apart from the radium, only barium was present, and it was out of the question that it was anything but radium. Bohr suggested that these new radium isotopes of ours might perhaps in the end turn out to be strange transuranic elements. Of the 16 activities they had identified in neutron-bombarded uranium, Hahn and Strassmann therefore now turned their full attention to the three controversial activities carried out of solution by barium. Laura Fermi woke to the telephone early on the morning of November 10th. A call would be placed from Stockholm, the operator advised her. Professor Fermi could expect it that evening at 6. Instantly awake to his wife's message, Fermi estimated the probability at 90% that the call would announce his Nobel Prize. As always, he had planned conservatively, not counting on the award. The Fermis had prepared to leave for the United States from Italy shortly after the first of the year. Ostensibly, Fermi was to lecture at Columbia for 7 months and then return. For stays of longer than 6 months, the United States required immigrant rather than tourist visas, and because Fermi was an academic, he and his family could be granted such visas outside the Italian quota list. The ruse of a lecture series was devised to evade a drastic penalty. Citizens leaving Italy permanently could take only the equivalent of $50 with them out of the country. But the plan required circumspection. The Fermis could not sell their household goods or entirely empty their savings account without risking discovery. So the money from the Nobel Prize would be a godsend. In the meantime, they invested surreptitiously in what Fermi called the refugee's trousseau. Laura's new coat was beaver, and they distracted themselves on the day of the Stockholm call shopping for expensive watches. Diamonds, which had to be registered, they chose not to risk. Near 6 o'clock, the phone rang. It was Hinestra Amaldi, wondering if they had heard. Everyone had gathered at the Amaldis to wait for the call, she reported. The Fermis turned on the 6 o'clock news. Laura long remembered the news. Hard, emphatic, pitiless, the commentator's voice read the second set of racial laws. The laws issued that day limited the activities and the civil status of the Jews. Their children were excluded from public schools, Jewish teachers were dismissed, Jewish lawyers, physicians, and other professionals could practice for Jewish clients only. Many Jewish firms were dissolved. Aryan servants were not allowed to work for Jews or to live in their homes. Jews were to be deprived of full citizenship rights, and their passports would be withdrawn. The passports of Jews had already been marked. Fermi had contrived to keep his wife's passport clear. They probably heard the news from Germany as well, of a vast pogrom the previous night, Kristallnacht, the night of glass. A 17-year-old Polish Jewish student had attempted to assassinate Ernst von Rath, third secretary in the German embassy in Paris, on November 7th, in reprisal for German mistreatment of the student's parents. Von Rath died on November 9th, and the assassination served as an excuse for general anti-Semitic riot. Mobs torched synagogues, destroyed businesses and stores, dragged Jewish families from their homes and beat them in the streets. At least 100 people died. A volume of plate glass was shattered that night across the Third Reich, equal to half the annual production of its original Belgian sources. The SS arrested some 30,000 Jewish men, especially rich ones, its order had specified, and packed them into the concentration camps at Buchenwald, Dachau, and Sachsenhausen, from which they could be ransomed only at the price of immediate, pauperized emigration. Fermi took the Stockholm call. The Nobel Prize, undivided, would be awarded for your discovery of new radioactive substances belonging to the entire race of elements, and for the discovery you made in the course of this work of the selective power of slow neutrons. In security, the Fermis could leave the madness behind. Lise Meitner had written Otto Hahn of her worries a few days before the Fermis arrived. "Most of the time I feel like a wind-up doll running on automatic," she told her old friend, smiling along happily and empty of real life. "From that you can judge for yourself how productive my efforts are at work, and still in the end I'm thankful for it, because it forces me to keep my thoughts together, which isn't always easy." She was sorry Hans' rheumatism had returned, and was afraid he wasn't taking care of himself. She asked after Planck and von Laue by their private Hahn Meitner nicknames, Max Sr. and Max Jr. She greeted Hahn's wife, Edith, and wondered what Christmas plans he had for his son. His uranium work was really very interesting. She hoped he would write again soon. She was living in a small hotel room. There was hardly space to unpack, and having trouble sleeping. People told her she was too thin. Worse conditions at the Physical Institute were not what she had expected them to be. A Swedish friend, Eva von Barbergius, a physicist she knew from Berlin, who had been a lecturer at the University of Uppsala, had helped with arrangements and was gradually breaking the bad news. Mana Siegmann had not wanted to take Meitner on. He had no money for her, he had complained. He could give her a place to work, but no more. Von Barbergius had pursued the Nobel Foundation grant, but it provided nothing for equipment or assistance. Meitner blamed herself. "Of course it's my fault. I should have prepared much better and much earlier for my leaving. Should at least have had drawings made of the most important apparatus I would need." She was a strong woman, but she was miserable and alone. Hahn responded with sympathy. At mid-month, she thanked him for that dear letter, then changed moods and charged him with indifference. "Concerning myself, I sometimes suspect you don't understand my way of thinking. Right now I really don't know if anyone cares about my affairs at all, or if they will ever be taken care of." Han was pursuing Meitner's affairs as well as his own. With her moody letter at hand, he stormed down to the revenue office, which was responsible for inventorying her furniture and other property before allowing its release, and laid on what he called a little seizure of my ecstasy, after which the matter went somewhat better. That news he wrote to Meitner on Monday evening, December 19th, from the KWI. Only then did he report why he had not yet left the laboratory. "As much as I can through all of this, I am working, and Strassmann is working, untiringly, on the uranium activities. It's almost 11 at night. Strassmann will return at 11:30 so that I can see about going home. The fact is, there's something so strange about the radium isotopes that for the time being we are mentioning it only to you. The half-lives of the three isotopes are quite precisely determined. They can be separated from all elements except barium. All the processes are in tune. Just one is not, unless there are extremely unusual coincidences. The fractionation doesn't work. Our radium isotopes act like barium." Han and Strassmann worked in three rooms on the ground floor of the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Chemistry, the building with the Pickelhaube Dome. Han's large personal chemistry laboratory north off the main lobby, a measurement room across the hall at the near end of the wing that extended northwest along Faradwig, and an irradiation room at the far end of the wing. They separated the three functions of irradiation, measurement, and chemistry to avoid contaminating one with radiation from another. All the rooms were fitted with work tables of unfinished raw pine roughed out by a careful carpenter who took the trouble to add a graceful taper to the legs. On the table in the irradiation room rested cylinders of beeswax-colored paraffin, like angel food cakes, drilled for the neutron sources, which were gram-strength radium salts mixed with beryllium powder. Handmade Geiger counters, fixed in hinged, hollowed-out bricks of lead shielding on the table in the measurement room, connected through thin coiling wires back to breadboard amplifiers worked by silvered vacuum tubes like inverted bud vases. The amplifiers actuated gleaming brass clockwork counters, with numbers showing black through angled miniature windows on their spines. Craftboard-covered 90-volt Petrix dry batteries that powered the system hacked a shelf below the table. Han's laboratory table held the brackets, beakers, flasks, funnels, and filters of radiochemistry. The two men moved in their work from room to room on a regular schedule, determined by the duration of the half-lives they were studying. There would have been a pungency of nitrates in the air, mingled with the aroma of Han's inevitable cigar. In his 59th year, Han stooped slightly, but looked younger than his age. His hairline had receded, and his eyebrows had grown bushy. He had trimmed back to the edge of his upper lip the waxed Prussian mustache of his youth. His brown eyes still sparkled with warmth. By now, he was unquestionably the ablest radiochemist in the world. He needed all his 40 years' experience to decode uranium. He and Strassmann had begun their renewed examination of the three radium isotopes early in December by attempting a purer separation from uranium. Strassmann suggested using barium chloride as a carrier rather than the customary barium sulfate because the chloride, Han explains, forms beautiful little crystals of exceptional purity. They wanted to be sure their separations would be free of contamination from other bombardment products with similar half-lives, the difficulty that had muddled Curie and Savage. The procedure for the 86-minute activity they were studying, which they called RA Roman numeral 3, required them to irradiate about 15 grams of purified uranium for 12 hours, wait several hours for their more intense 14-minute RA Roman numeral 2 to retreat from the foreground by decaying, Then add barium chloride as a carrier and accomplish the separation. The Ra3 came out of the uranium solution with the barium, but it refused then to remain behind during fractionation when the barium crystallized away. Instead, it crystallized with the barium. The attempts to separate our artificial radium isotopes from barium in this way were unsuccessful, Hahn would explain in his Nobel Prize lecture. No enrichment of the radium was obtained. It was natural to ascribe this lack of success to the exceptionally low intensity of our preparations. It was always a question of merely a few thousands of atoms, which could only be detected as individual particles by the Geiger-Müller counter. Such a small number of atoms could be carried away by the great excess of inactive barium without any increase or decrease being perceptible. To check that possibility, they retrieved from storage a known radium isotope they often worked with, the isotope they called mesothorium. They diluted it to match the pale radioactivity of their few thousand atoms of Ra3, then ran it through barium precipitation and fractionation. It separated away cleanly from the barium. Their technique was not at fault. On Saturday, December 17th, the day after Hahn stormed the revenue office on behalf of Meitner's furniture, he and Strassmann carried out a further heroic check. They mixed Ra3 with dilute mesothorium and precipitated and fractionated the two substances together. Then the chemical evidence was certain, whatever it might mean in physical terms. The mesothorium remained in solution when the barium carrier crystallized out, but Ra3 went off with the barium, distributing itself uniformly and indivisibly throughout the small, pure crystals. Hahn wrote an enthusiastic note in his pocket appointment book to mark the day. Exciting fractionation of radium/barium/mesothorium. It seemed their radium isotopes must be barium, element 56, slightly more than half as heavy as uranium, and with just over half its charge. Hahn and Strassmann could hardly believe it. They conceived an even more convincing experiment. If their radium was really radium, then by beta decay it ought to transform itself one step up the periodic table to actinium, 89. If, on the other hand, it was barium, 56, then by beta decay it ought to transform itself one step up to lanthanum, 57. And lanthanum could be separated from actinium by fractionation. They were carrying out this definitive project late Monday night, December 19th, when Hahn sent Meitner the news. "Perhaps we can suggest some fantastic explanation," he wrote. "We understand that it really can't break up into barium. So try to think of some other possibility. Barium isotopes with much higher atomic weights than 137? If you can think of anything that might be publishable, then the three of us would be together in this work after all. We don't believe this is foolishness or that contaminations are playing tricks on us." He closed by wishing his friend a somewhat bearable Christmas. Fritz Strassmann added, "Very warm greetings and best wishes." Hahn posted the letter to Stockholm late at night on his way home. The two men took time from their readings to attend the annual KWI Christmas party the next day, though Hahn had little joy of it with Meitner gone. They continued the actinium-lanthanum experiment even as they worked up the radium-barium findings. After the party, the institute would close for Christmas. They kept a typist busy until the end, but were unable to finish their report. Hahn had called Paul Rosbaud at Naturwissenschaften, told him the news, and asked him to make space in the next issue. Rosbaud was willing to pull a less urgent paper from the journal, but cautioned that the manuscript must be delivered no later than Friday, December 23rd. Hahn arranged for a laboratory assistant to serve as typist on Thursday. In the meantime, he and Strassmann would carry on alone. Meitner received Hahn's Monday night letter in Stockholm on Wednesday, December 21st. It was startling. If the results held, she saw it meant the uranium nucleus must fracture, and she immediately wrote him back, Your radium results are very amazing. A process that works with slow neutrons and leads to barium. To me, for the time being, the hypothesis of such an extensive burst seems very difficult to accept. But we have experienced so many surprises in nuclear physics that one cannot say without hesitation about anything. It's impossible. She was traveling on Friday to the village of Kungälv in the west of Sweden for a week's vacation, she told Hahn. If you write me in the meantime, please address your letter there. She sent him and his family warmest greetings, and much love and the very best for the new year. That day, Hahn and Strassmann had finished the actinium-lanthanum experiment and confirmed lanthanum from barium decay. In the late evening, after they turned off their counters, Hahn wrote his exiled colleague again. The paper was not yet finished. A phrase from the letter would be reworked to more cautious language for the final draft. Our radium proofs convince us that as chemists, we must come to the conclusion that the three carefully studied isotopes are not radium, but, from the standpoint of the chemist, barium. Hahn had hoped Meitner might quickly find some physical explanation for his unprecedented chemistry. That would strengthen his conclusion, and also put Meitner's name on the paper, the best possible Christmas gift. With the lanthanum confirmation at hand, he could no longer delay. As it was, he had withheld the news from physicists on his own staff and at the new physics institute nearby. Someone else, Yuri and Savitch, for example, might very well have made the same discovery. And whatever the explanation, the discovery was clearly of major importance, a reaction unlike any other yet found. We cannot hush up the results, Hahn wrote to Meitner, even though they may be absurd in physical terms. You can see that you will be performing a good deed if you find an alternative explanation. When we finish tomorrow or the day after, I will send you a copy of the manuscript. The whole thing is not very well suited for Naturwissenschaften, but they will publish it quickly. Hahn mailed the letter to Stockholm. He did not yet know about Meitner's Kungälv vacation. Leo Szilard's work at the University of Rochester confirmed that no neutrons came out when indium was irradiated. On December 21st, as Hahn and Meitner exchanged their excited letters, Szilard advised the British Admiralty by letter. Further experiments have definitely cleared up the anomalies which I have observed in 1936. In view of this new work, it does not now seem necessary to maintain my patent, nor would the waiving of the secrecy of this patent serve any useful purpose. I beg, therefore, to suggest that the patent be withdrawn altogether. Szilard's faith in the possibility of a chain reaction, as he said later, had just about reached the vanishing point. Hahn and Strassmann had originally titled their paper On the Radium Isotopes Produced by the Neutron Bombardment of Uranium and Their Behavior. With their new data, they realized radium would no longer do. They considered changing radium to barium throughout the paper, but most of it had been written before the lanthanum experiment firmed their convictions. They would have had to rewrite from beginning to end, especially, says Hahn in retrospect, since in view of this result, its major portion was not especially interesting anymore. Christmas and the journal deadline were upon them, and they had no time. They decided to jury-rig what was on hand. The results would be no less effective for being inelegant. They substituted the non-committal phrase alkaline earth metals for radium isotopes in the title. Both barium and radium are alkaline earth metals, as are beryllium, magnesium, calcium, and strontium. They went through the draft putting equivocal quotation marks around their many references to radium and actinium. Then they attached 7 cautious paragraphs at the end. Now we still have to discuss some newer experiments, this final section began, which we publish rather hesitantly due to their peculiar results. They then summarized their series of experiments. We wanted to identify beyond any doubt the chemical properties of the parent members of the radioactive series which were separated with the barium and which have been designated as radium isotopes. We have carried out fractional crystallizations and fractional precipitations, a method which is well known for concentrating or diluting radium in barium salt solutions. When we made appropriate tests with radioactive barium samples, which were free of any later decay products, the results were always negative. The activity was distributed evenly among all the barium fractions. We come to the conclusion that our radium isotopes have the properties of barium. As chemists, we should actually state that the new products are not radium, but rather barium itself. Other elements besides radium or barium are out of the question. They discussed actinium then, distinguished their work from that of Curie and Savitch, and pointed out that all so-called transuranics would have to be re-examined. Not quite prepared to usurp the prerogative of the physicists, they closed on a tentative note. As chemists, we really ought to revise the decay scheme given above and insert the symbols Ba, La, Ce, cerium, in place of Ra, Ac, Th, thorium. However, as nuclear chemists, working very close to the field of physics, we cannot bring ourselves yet to take such a drastic step, which goes against all previous laws of nuclear physics. There could perhaps be a series of unusual coincidences which has given us false indications. Promising further experiments, they prepared to release their news to the world. Hahn mailed the paper, and then felt the whole thing to be so improbable that I wished I could get the document back out of the mailbox. Or Paul Rosebaud came around to the KWI the same evening to pick it up. Both stories survive Hahn's later recollections. Since Rosebaud knew the paper's importance and dated its receipt December 22, 1938, he probably picked it up. But Hahn also visited the mailbox that night to send a carbon copy of the seminal paper to Lise Meitner in Stockholm. His misgivings at publishing without her, or some dawning glimmer of the fateful consequences that might follow his discovery, may have accounted for his remembered apprehension. The Swedish village of Kungälv, the name means King's River, is located some 10 miles above the dominant western harbor city of Göteborg and 6 miles inland from the Kattegat coast. The river, now called North River, descends from Lake Vänern, the largest freshwater lake in Western Europe. At Kungälv, it has cut a sheer granite southward-facing bluff, the precipice of Fontin, 335 feet high. The modern village is built along a single cobblestone lane on the narrow talus between the bluff and the river, its back to the wall. As Norwegian Kongahalla, the village was founded at a less constricted place downstream around AD 800. But an island hill rises from the river at Kungälv and is thus guarded by a natural moat, a defensive geography, which the precipice of Fontin reinforces. In 1308, to mark the border there between Norway and Sweden, the Norwegians began to build on that island hill a monumental granite fortress, Bohusfasta, that is, King Bohus Fort. Sod-ridged block walls mazing inward and upward to a cylindrical tower of thick stone with a conical roof that dominates the entire coastal valley. An accident of placement of 3 of the deep windows that penetrate the tower, 2 open above, 1 centered below, transforms it into a face staring with hollow eyes toward the Fontin Bluff. To soften the grimness of that face, the people of the valley named the tower Farshat, Father's Hat, as if it evoked a workman in a cap. Through 400 years of occupation, Bohusfasta was besieged 14 times, while the settlements in the valley were put to the torch and the graveyard filled on the island below its hard walls. The village was ordered moved upriver onto the island in 1612. The Danes ruled Norway from the 15th century to the early 19th century. They ceded the Kungälv region, Bohuslän, to Sweden by the Treaty of Roskilde in 1658. Fire in 1676 burned the island village and its burghers shifted for safety to the narrow shore. They laid out their lane and strip of houses extended west and east from a cobblestone marketplace where the talus widened to make room. Despite its fortress, Kungälv is peaceful, especially in winter, with the river frozen and a depth of clean snow on the ground. Its snug wooden houses, painted pastel, enclose rooms cozy with ship's chests and china cabinets and lace curtains, warmed by corner fireplaces faced with decorative tile, aromatic with coffee and baking. Eva von Barbergius and her husband Niklas built a house there in 1927, larger than most Kungälv houses, but constructed in the same style. In 1938, Lise Meitner was alone in Stockholm. Otto Frisch was alone in Copenhagen. His mother, Meitner's sister, beyond reach in Vienna. His father, incarcerated at Dachau, a victim of Kristallnacht. The Bergiuses therefore considerately invited aunt and nephew to Kungälv for Christmas dinner. Meitner left Stockholm Friday morning, 2 days before Christmas. Frisch took the train ferry across from Denmark. His aunt arrived before him and registered at a quiet inn on Vastergatan, West Street, where they both would stay, a pale green building much like its modest neighbors, but with a café on the ground floor. It faced a shadowed strip of garden, north across the lane. Above the stunted garden trees, the dark bluff loomed. The other way, behind the inn, the flat, snow-covered floodplain of the river extended into open woods. The Bergius's house was a short walk eastward past the marketplace and the White Church. Tired from travel, Frisch and Meitner met only briefly in the evening, when Frisch came in. In Copenhagen that winter, he had been studying the magnetic behavior of neutrons. To further his work, he needed a strong, uniform magnetic field, and on his way to Kungälv, he had sketched out a large magnet he meant to design and build. He came downstairs on the morning before Christmas, prepared to interest his aunt in his plans. She was already at breakfast, and had no intention of discussing magnets. She had brought Hans' December 19th letter downstairs with her, and insisted Frisch read it. He did. "Barium," he told her. "I don't believe it. There's some mistake." He tried to change the subject to his magnet. She changed it back to barium. "Finally," says Meitner, "we both became absorbed in my problem." They decided to go for a walk to see what they could puzzle out. Frisch had brought cross-country skis and wanted to use them. He was concerned that his aunt would be unable to keep up. She could walk as fast as he could ski on level ground, she told him. She could, and did. He fetched his skis, and they went out, probably eastward to the Kungälv marketplace, which gave onto the floodplain of the river, then across the frozen river, and into the open woods beyond. "But it's impossible," Frisch remembers them saying in their collective effort to understand. "You couldn't chip 100 particles off a nucleus in one blow. You couldn't even cut it across. If you tried to estimate the nuclear forces, all the bonds you'd have to cut all at once, it's fantastic. It's quite impossible that a nucleus could do that." 30 years afterward, Frisch summarized their thinking in more formal terms. "But how could barium be formed from uranium? No larger fragments than protons or helium nuclei, alpha particles, had ever been chipped away from nuclei. And the thought that a large number of them should be chipped off at once could be dismissed. Not enough energy was available to do that. Nor was it possible that the uranium nucleus could have been cleaved right across. Indeed, a nucleus was not like a brittle solid that could be cleaved or broken. Bohr had stressed that a nucleus was much more like a liquid drop. The liquid drop model made a division of the nucleus seem possible. They sat down on a log. Meitner found a scrap of paper and a pencil in her purse. She drew circles. "Couldn't it be this sort of thing?" Frisch. Now, she always rather suffered from an inability to visualize things.